This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, you're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything Tom, Richard and myself have been up to on Thursday, March the 30th, which includes, by the way, wishing Richard Dean a very happy birthday. He is 51. What else have we been doing? We've been looking at the appointment of a new vice president for the UAE. We've also been having a look at the stability of our banking system. New report out from the guys at KPMG. We've been speaking to one of their managing partners, Abbas Bazrai. And I've been in Silicon Valley recently. You may have heard, we've been talking about it a little bit, at just the right or the wrong time for the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. I've been looking about what that means for venture capital and for startups and why we're seeing what one venture capitalist who I spoke to called a funding desert. He's Arjun Sethi. My interview with him is here as well. And we've been looking at whether or not we're going to all be replaced by ChatGPT after a new report out from Goldman Sachs suggested that as many as 300 million jobs could go. Oscar Oriola Haider is from Robert Walters Middle East, their recruitment and headhunters. He came in to give us his verdict.
Let's get more on that top story. Big changes in the leadership of the UAE. We have a new vice president, Sheikh Mansour in Abu Dhabi, is vice president, alongside His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, who remains the vice president and prime minister of the UAE, as well as ruler of Dubai. Let's hear from Sheikh Mansour now. This is him speaking a few years ago now, here in Dubai, actually, at the World Government Summit in Arabic. And he's talking about the importance of the young population, not just in the UAE, but across the Arab world.
ولكن هذه الأرقام زيادة أغلى موارد العالم العربي وأغلى ما نملك جميعا ألا وهو الشباب العربي.
So we spoke to Khatija Haq this morning from Emirates MBD. She's the chief economist. She and the team have been looking at this one closely. And we asked her, as we would with any such changes in any country, what are the potential economic implications, if any, from the appointments, well, several new appointments, but predominantly a new vice president, also a new crown prince in Abu Dhabi. This is Khatija Haq.
Sheikh Khalid bin Mohammed has been appointed Abu Dhabi's new crown prince. This was widely expected by political analysts. Sheikh Khalid has already held key roles in the main Abu Dhabi entities. He was chairman of the Abu Dhabi Executive Office since 2019 and also a member of ADNOC's board of directors since 2021. And he's thus been involved in the main economic policy initiatives that have been announced over the last few years. So that would include the strategy to develop high-value manufacturing, to invest and develop space and other technologies, and of course the energy transition policy of the UAE, which is going to be a big focus over the next decade or so.
I think in general terms, Brandy, we've all been here for more than 20 years. We've seen, of course, changes in leadership. Sheikh Zayed was the president when we moved here. And of course, we've moved through that transition. And Sheikh Maktoum was the ruler of Dubai. But the thread of economic policy has been pretty consistent, hasn't it, throughout?
Yeah, and I would say that one of the reasons for that is the fact that we make very long-term plans. I mean, how many 10-year plans have you and I been to the launch of? And because those plans are long-term, you're not seeing, as you do in, you know, other countries, shifts every sort of new bloke, if that makes sense.
No, it's true. I mean, everyone's
not got that he's a new bloke, but you know what I'm saying. There's the long-term plans underpin the direction.
Everyone's got their own ideas, and that's fine, and you want that, and it freshens things up. But really, in terms of long-term fundamentals, it's been pretty consistent for the 2.5 decades we've been here.
Yeah, and we've seen, particularly in the last 12 to 18 months, I would say, a number of long-term strategies put in place, whether they are new technology strategies, the big manufacturing strategy. We've seen this week a new goal set when it comes to re-exports, haven't we, to basically double the size of the re-export market here. And these are all, I'm not going to use the V word, but these are all long-term plans.
there's even a Project 2071, isn't there,
yeah,
for the 100th anniversary of the country. Whether we are around to see that in the Business Breakfast studio is debatable. What else can we talk about? Can we talk about banks, Brandy Scott? You had a fascinating interview earlier on today with the guys from KPMG, didn't you, about stability or otherwise in the UAE banking sector.
Yeah, we're going to hear in about 25 minutes from the KPMG partner that I've been speaking to this morning. They've come out really timely, actually, with a report into the stability of UAE banks. Very timely, because obviously at the moment everyone's asking questions about the stability of the global banking system. So I've been chatting to the guys at KPMG about whether or not there's anything to worry about, really, to put that in context. How do we measure a bank's stability at the moment? Are those measurements changing, particularly since what should have been a safe-as-houses investment, you know, US Treasuries, long-term bonds, have been what's done for banks in the US who've had to cash them in early to meet the desires and the demands of depositors. Do we need to look at these things differently? We're going to hear from the KPMG managing partner that I've spoken to in about 25 minutes.
But overall, the conclusion from Abbas Basri was the banks here are in good shape. Is that a fair...
Spoiler.
Is that a fair conclusion?
Yes, but what's really interesting is the reasons that he gives for that, particularly when we talk about foreign capital and foreign investment coming in and how long it might stay here. So even though Richard's just given the game away, there's still something to listen for.
He's great value, actually. You're going to enjoy that interview with Abbas Basri a little bit later on. Thomas, let's talk about international business stories. You've been looking at Howard Schultz.
He's just come in for a bit of a grueling, really, at the moment. The Starbucks chief is under the... There's a lot of these sort of committee things going on at the moment, whether across the world at present. The UK seem to be taking a little bit of a leaf out of the US books. US committee hearings traditionally can get a little bit fiery, and we've seen that lately. Who was the... It was the American head of TikTok, wasn't it, who got a grilling the other day?
Yeah. And the phrase...
I can't remember his name.
But the phrase that we used was grandstanding. And you mentioned this as well, Brandy. So you get these grillings of business leaders like Howard Schultz or the CEO of TikTok or whatever it is. But the politicians know the cameras are rolling.
Yeah, and it is your chance to make Taylor Swift puns if the guys in front of you are the ticket sellers for the Taylor Swift concert. Everyone, constantly somebody testifying at the moment, do you not think, in front of one of these Senate committees. Do the Senate actually spend any time being actual senators or just... grilling Mr. Coffee about whether or not he's a union buster?
It is their time in the spotlight. And Howard Schultz is the man who's been up. It's a bit unfair, really. He's just left his job last week. So it's a bit unfair that the first thing he has to do, having embraced retirement for the third time to spend his billions, is to then sit in front of a load of politicians who are absolutely grilling you about the fact that that you are union busting. His line, or the line that came out of it, basically this comes from this allegation of union busting in the States. The Howard Schultz, the former Starbucks chief executive, went on the offensive yesterday in front of the committee, saying, basically, I came from nothing. Don't talk to me about union busting. I'll talk to you, you know, I'll tell you about union busting. There's a lot of finger pointing going on. Despite the fact that Labour officials in the US consistently reporting that the firm has broken federal laws in its response, including wrongfully firing of workers. Case continues.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Where we are talking banking now, with questions being asked around the world about the stability of the global banking system, it is an excellent time for KPMG to come out with a report into the stability of ours. Very pleased to be joined by Abbas Basri, who is a partner and head of financial services at KPMG for the Lower Gulf. Abbas, it's lovely to see you.
Pleasure being here. First and foremost, thank you very much for having me. And more importantly, Ramadan Kareem to you, your families and all your listeners.
Shall we start with the question that the Business Breakfast was asking each other this morning, which is, are we looking, with these jitters about bank stability and the couple of collapses that we've had, at another banking crisis? Or is this just sentiment contagion, as Citi put it earlier this week?
Look, Brandy, I would say it's a bit of volatility and stress, right? I won't call it a crisis just yet. I think it's important to understand from a UAE perspective, the UAE banking sector in the year 2022 has a promising year and maintains a stable outlook for 2023, with a bit of focus on improving digital penetration, customer experience, and so on and so forth. There are a few ratios which are quite important, right? How is profitability doing? How is the asset growth? So profitability, we analyzed top 10 banks, listed banks in the UAE. It's gone up in 2022 by 31%. Assets have gone up by 10.8%. the capital and liquidity remains very solid for these banks. And yes, you've heard of the volatility and stress in the global financial system. However, I think the UAE banks are very well prepared to take that head on.
How catching is it almost? How contagious is the sentiment?
I think it all depends on the exposures that the banking sector has, right? If you were to look at the UAE banking sector and to see what they're exposed to internationally from an exposure perspective, there is less of what you've heard in the past, right? With some of the other banks that are going through some of the challenges. So I don't think it's as contagious, but look, it's a global recession happening internationally, right? At some stage, do you see those things coming this way? But in 2023, from my perspective, it is a stable outlook. And more importantly, I think we need to understand that the UAE banking system is an integral part of the UAE's growth agenda. What that means is there have been occasions the government, the regulator, have really reformed the governance framework, the focus, the regulatory reforms that they've had. And from that perspective, I think they're pretty well settled.
Do we need to change what we look at when we look at the health of a bank at the moment? Because one of the things, obviously, that set this off in the US was the long-term bond holdings that some of those banks had. Do we need new parameters?
No. So again, I think the long-term bond holdings, I'm not going to talk specifics on some of these other banks, but if you looked at their percentages, they were quite high compared to the size of the balance sheet, right? If you compare that for the UAE banking sector, which is what we did, it's less than 10% of the overall balance sheet, which is exposed to long-term bonds. And more importantly, I don't see an interest rate mismatch here. Wherever there are long-dated bonds invested in, I think you do see enough interest rate hedging happening just to manage the market risk aspect of it.
What about that capital that you mentioned and your report goes into? You say in the report that one of the things that has helped the banks here in 2022 is the inflows of foreign investment.
Correct.
And capital. Is there a potential vulnerability there if global situations ease, if they change and some of that capital or individuals could leave us?
So Brandy, I've been here for 10 years, and one of the things I've learned being in the UAE is when things don't go right outside the UAE typically benefits because of the conducive environment that they set out for investors to come in, make things quite easy. Setting up businesses here are quite easy, and the standard of living is great. I mean, COVID accelerated some of that as well because of the healthcare system elsewhere, which is why many people have moved over the last 3 years to this part of the world, setting up their businesses, bringing in that foreign investments, and that's what the banks really enjoy, right? They have their excess liquidity to do what they need to do properly.
What about lending? This is one of the big things globally. A lot of economists are predicting a lot of tightening on lending, particularly unsecured lending. What's your outlook here?
So if you look at the banking sector here, and if you look at the lending, what is secured, what is unsecured, I think you typically find a 60-40 split. You'll never see a banking sector where you'll have completely unsecured or completely secured lending, right? But I think the UAE, if you look at where things are from a coverage perspective, their NPL ratios are less than 6%. Provision coverage is close to 70%. And I don't really see, and why provision coverage 70% is okay is because of some of the collateral that they have. So these are not unsecured lending. A lot of that is secured lending.
A lot of it's going to be mortgage as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And absolutely. And the way you say where the property market is heading over the last 3 years, I think that's relatively stable at the moment, unless there's a turnaround.
What about, and I'm deliberately playing devil's advocate here, by the way, what about people's ability to pay back their mortgages or to refinance as interest rates rise?
Look, that's a fair challenge, right? Because as soon as interest rates go up, there is a bit of stress that generally consumers have. I'll give you my own example. I have a mortgage here, right? And I think we've sort of been used to a low interest rate environment for a very long period. And I think at some stage, you've sort of maintained your lifestyle based on that low interest rate environment. When interest rates suddenly go up, there is going to be a bit of stress. I believe there will be by the end of this year some elements of stress from a mortgage book perspective. However, that as a percentage is not going to be huge. For me, the important thing is even if some of those stress comes to the banking sector, I think because the banking sector is very well capitalized and the profitability is strong, they'll easily adopt it.
30 seconds left with you. Does KPMG have an interest rate outlook? Where do you think they're going?
From an economist perspective, we don't really, but we do follow everything which is going on. I think I do expect one more rise coming through. And we'll see how inflation in the foreign world changes. Once that changes, we'll hopefully see interest rates coming down at some stage.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Abbas Bezrai is a partner and head of financial services at KPMG Lower Gulf, coming in to the studio with his very timely report on the strength of the UAE banking system.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Let's have a look at not just the capital of capital, but the capital of venture capital, because that's what they call Menlo Park. And I took the Caltrain over to Menlo Park last week when I was in San Francisco, because I wanted to see what the venture capitalists made of the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. I spoke to Arjun Sethi. Now, he's a VC investor. He's co-founder of Tribe Capital. And he's no stranger to this region either. He raises money and he invests in the US, obviously, but also the Middle East and India in areas from AI to space. So the idea was to talk to him about the collapse of SVB once the initial shock had died down. But we ended instead talking about whether or not there was any capital out there, or much of it, to start with. He didn't think the collapse of SVB was going to affect VCs and their ability to invest very much. However, one of the interesting things that he did say on the bank was that having to worry about the safety of deposits, which was one of the big knock-on effects of SVB for startups and new companies, could bring an extra headache for the companies investing in them.
Whenever you think about any company at the early stage, their main focus and goal is to get their product to become a business and then sort of reduce the risk of all the other things that can happen to make that might make them fail. And so when they go from early to mid to late stage as an organization, one of the things that you want as an investor is for them to focus primarily on their customers and your product. You don't really want them to focus on macroeconomic terms, interest rates, or, you know, is your deposit safe? So I think a larger issue is that if you have to have treasury management as a part of your function internally as an expertise, it's just another layer of burden in order for a company to succeed.
So ideally, you want your founders to be building stuff and not worrying about if the bank is going to collapse. But we moved off SVB really quickly because I'd read an investment note that Arjun had written. And he said we had a funding desert at the moment, that funding before the bank malarkey that's been going on was already extremely tight.
So we're basically at the worst time in history that's measurable in terms of access to capital and funding rounds worldwide. So in the US, one of our worst dry periods was in 2000. And so from 2000 to 2004, it was pretty dry. And then by 2004, you know, liquidity started coming back into the ecosystem and people were more risk on. We're right now at the levels of 2000 and 2001, but it's actually just a little bit worse. So what that means is that it'll take, in my opinion, 3 to 4 years for the asset class to come back and bounce back.
So what needs to happen for that bounce back?
Now, what happens is that the asset class needs a lot of things to bounce back. One, you need enough entrepreneurs, you need enough good companies, you need enough access to capital and liquidity, and then you need enough exits and M&A, et cetera. So the whole lifeblood of the ecosystem has to work in tandem. Now, in the US, we have an ecosystem, so we're much more bound to bounce back. But places like Latin America, Southeast Asia, Middle East, where this is maybe their first or second cycle, it's harder for them to bounce back from these things. So the only market where we've seen that started to bounce back, or they're just at the cusp of the bottom of what we call it, is India. And so I think when you take a look at what are the markets that are going to come back faster, it's most likely United States, India, and most likely investable China.
So why do we have a funding desert to start with? Why is the market so dry for capital at the moment?
Well, there's a couple of things. At a central bank level, not just here in the United States, but worldwide, we're moving the rates up. And then we've also reduced access to liquidity in some cases. So we call it from moving over from QE to QT, which is where the Fed is not going to be backstopping certain types of securities, or they're not the buyer of last resort. Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is that you start thinking about your portfolio construction if you're a large institution all the way down. And so when that happens very quickly and you've had the rates change very quickly and you've had tightening very quickly, everyone kind of retreats. You're a deer in the headlight and you don't really make a lot of changes. And so everyone's just kind of waiting to see what stability will look like, and then they'll start redeploying, you know, across all the asset classes that they have.
But while you're waiting, what advice does he have for startups to cope with leaner funding times?
Survive and thrive. How do you tighten your belt? How do you sort of reduce the cost that you have? It's a pretty simple formula. What's your revenue minus cost? And is that negative or positive? And even if it's negative, what's the type of cash flow that you have and the amount of time that you have for the market to rebound? Again, I'm a venture capitalist. So my primary goal is to invest capital into something that's going to grow at a high velocity. So that it's risk for growth. that's just the name of our game. That is exactly what our asset class is for. That's why we get capital from endowments and pension funds, or why we work hard in that direction, is to find these companies. And it's usually a small set. So out of the 40,000 companies that get venture funded every single year, there's probably going to be no more than 40 to 50 that'll get to, let's call it, you know, true intrinsic value of $1 billion and above. And that's kind of what I focus my time on.
So he's looking at some big money, some of which, by the way, he's raising not a million miles from here. And it was a very Silicon Valley interview. As I said, we were in Menlo Park. We were actually in a nearly empty house that he was working out of. There was a guy on a laptop in the kitchen doing whatever it is you do if you're a VC at sort of, you know, 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. It was a really interesting insight into the world. And as I said, I went initially to talk about SVB, but we just got on to what he saw, I think, as being the bigger picture. And he did say that he didn't see the Silicon Valley Bank collapse as being any kind of tipping point in economic history. But, and this is very interesting for us, he said that there are other big picture changes underway when it comes to how and where startups are looking for funding.
I think the one thing that people kind of forget about is that technology innovation sector, the venture community, et cetera, worldwide, is actually the driving force of most economies. And so you actually need that part of the economy to continue to survive and continue to thrive and continue to build innovative products, you know, including job restoration. And so I think what I worry more about is overall macroeconomic policies stifling and having headwinds towards companies and people to be able to innovate or take the risks in the first place. We have a good real world example today, which is where you had a lot of innovation, but now you have a lot of headwinds where it stifles innovation. And that's just Europe sort of writ large. Distribution is hard. Regulatory environment is hard. Being able to hire people is hard. Being able to lay people off is hard. Being able to incentivize them is hard. The taxation upon like starting a company is hard. So what happens is that if you stifle every single aspect of being able to just start something and get it up and running, you just have less of it. And it's one of the reasons why people sort of leave that. And one of the reasons why you've seen Singapore, Dubai, and Abu Dhabi, obviously the United States continue to see that inflow, is that it's, you don't have that same friction. I have a bunch of companies that have been based in India, moved to Dubai. I have a bunch of companies that have been based in Europe, moved to Dubai. And again, they're still offering the same services, but they're able to get access to capital, services, and products for them specifically. So when you think about tailoring towards growth and innovation economy, who is that going to be? And I think like SVB, again, was a pillar of that. But who are the other folks that are going to be able to step in? Or is there going to be a hole? That's still going to be TBD. But my sense is that these things get figured out fairly quickly.
And that's Arjun Sethi, now VC investor, co-founder of Tribe Capital, speaking to me in Menlo Park in Silicon Valley.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Right, let's turn our attention back to AI, continuing that conversation now. Why? Well, a whole load of evidence being presented to us. The first piece of evidence was, of course, that report coming out from Goldman Sachs that's got everyone talking. Growing adoption of artificial intelligence technology can help boost global economic growth, but it also and raise labour productivity. But it may well also affect 300 million jobs, was one of the findings of that extensive research. That was backed up overnight by this new letter from Musk and his mates, some of the biggest names in tech, calling for AI labs to stop the training of the most powerful AI systems for at least 6 months. They want a six-month hiatus, citing profound risks to society and humanity. However, progress continues. UAE residents waking up this morning to news that they can look forward to robot massages. Yep, AI-powered surgery and high-tech health and beauty is just round the corner, according to robotics experts here in the country. Game-changing medical robots could revolutionise healthcare, according to RoboSculptor. They would say that, wouldn't they? Right, let's find out whether the masseurs and the nurses and the journalists and the real estate agents and the architects are all losing their jobs in the next couple of... They're getting sacked in the morning, are they? Let's find out, because we're joined in the studio by the head of financial services at Robert Walters Middle East. Oscar Orellana Haider joins us live this morning. Oscar, thanks for joining us.
Not at all. Thank you.
What's your take on automation? I'm reading that Goldman Sachs report yesterday, and they basically turn around and say, look, They were looking at sort of industries that were going to be most affected. And it looked at architects, it looked at journalists, it looked at artists to a certain degree. The ones that they were saying were less immune, well, not immune, but less exposure to this, were more sort of hands-on, like construction. Where do you read it when it comes to the future of jobs?
Yeah, I mean, we could speak for hours and hours on this. The article from Goldman Sachs and their predicted numbers, it's massive, isn't it? 300 million is a bit scary. I think what you've just described there is true to a certain extent, but I think what we're going to see is more the manufacturing, more the heavy industrial engineering, potentially higher risk to human beings. Whereas if a robot's doing that job, there's not necessarily as risk of that robot getting injured at work, for example, potentially the worst case scenario at work, for example. So that's one thing. A lot of people have been saying lawyers as well, because with ChatGPT and AI and all the automatic finding of the words in documents, they're at risk. But again, I think, you know, what is a law firm? What is a lawyer's modus operandi without a pitch, without a human behind it, without a human putting together all the document and selling their services? So as always, I've been asked loads of times on this, there always needs to be a human touch behind that robot, as it were.
So the innovators here are still humans at the moment?
Mm. I would say so. I would say so. Because, again, it will be creating hundreds of jobs making these robots. So a little stat for you, Tom. Supposedly, the industrial robotics industry will be worth something like $350 billion by 2030, which is massive. So, you know, anyone who's got that gig, who's making the robots, let me know, and I'll send my CV. But no, in all seriousness, I think look, there's opportunity everywhere. I think Goldman Sachs is one of the names to come out and give this big PR. I think a reason behind this, sorry, not to answer your question directly, is the banks have been beaten up and they've been bleeding out a little bit.
Uh-huh.
So they have to put out good PR. They have to show face to their investors, to their shareholders. And also it gives them an edge on market intelligence, what sectors are going well, what sectors are going badly, potentially opportunity, potentially mitigating risk. That's what it's all about.
I mean, we were speaking a little bit earlier with the team from Override.ai, and they were talking about, you know, the impact it had, the positive impact it could have in terms of efficiency and workload changes. That's just something we're going to have to accept, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We're all, as you said, in your little list of professions there, journalists, real estate agents, recruitment, we're all going to adapt to it. We're all going to have to integrate it into our daily lives. But again, it needs us to be pumping in. I had a play around on ChatGPT. It's incredibly long. It can be glitchy. It's not perfect. So all of these, whether it's robotics, whether it's basic AI tools, they're going to have human beings behind them.
So let's go back to that report. So in the US, 25% of current work tasks could be automated by AI, says the report. Sectors most at risk, administrative, 46%, legal, 44% as well. Physically intensive professions such as construction maintenance have low exposure. Is that going to impact career choices for people moving forward?
For sure. Yeah, there was something that got put out yesterday on Bloomberg that they're paying $300,000 for these new jobs of programming the robotics, programming the tech behind it. And these are young guys, you know, 0 to 3 years of experience. And some of them, they don't even need a software or an analytics degree. And these companies are paying them way over market rate in comparison to, you know, your average lawyer will get X amount, your average banker, entry-level banker will get Y amount. If you become a software developer, if you become an AI machine learning guru without a degree and you get into the right company at the right time, you can make three times what a lawyer makes. So, yeah, I genuinely feel it will be.
So there's no industry that's more prone to automation than others?
Look, I think manufacturing, I think legal to a certain extent, I think hospitals, definitely. Mm. If that can benefit or if that can improve the efficiencies in healthcare and hospitals, for sure. But no, I think people will love the doom and gloom. I don't think you and I and everyone in this room is going to leave their job overnight.
Okay, yeah. Well, and just to end on that one, well, we've got 30 seconds left or so, Oscar. And just in terms of that, you know, let's try and put a time frame on this. I mean, is this a change overnight, or how far down the line are we looking?
So that market cap number was 2030. I think it might be sooner. I think it might be end of 28, 29. That's when we're going to, all of us around here, every sector that we've just spoken about, will have a daily interaction with these AI tools and robotic sort of professions as well.
So get your head around them.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Understand them.
Yeah, adapt, overcome, and get on with it.
That's the upskilling of today, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Understanding anyone, those. Yeah.
Whatever age, whatever profession, like absorb it, and because it's here to stay.
Great. Well, hopefully we're all here to stay, and hopefully we can invite you back into the studio in the next couple of weeks.
Love to.
Unless we've all been replaced by bots, all right? Oscar, always good to catch up with you, my mate.
Thanks
so much indeed for that. Oscar Orelin Haider is the head of financial services at Robert Walters Middle East.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.